Welcome, everyone, to the sixth live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Dr. Peter Levine will be teaching on trauma and memory, brain and body, in search for the living past. He's broadcasting live from Encinitas, California, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now it's my honor to introduce to you Dr. Peter Levine. Dr. Peter Levine is a forerunner in body-oriented approaches to trauma. He is the developer of somatic experiencing, a naturalistic approach to healing trauma, and he's received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the United States Association for Body Psychotherapy in recognition of his original and pioneering work. He's also received an honorary award as the Rhys Davis Chair for his lifetime contribution to infant and child psychiatry. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Christy. Good to be back in the halls of Sounds True.
We're happy to have you. Honored.
Okay. You know, the question of trauma and memory, traumatic memory, and even memory itself, it's really poorly understood. And memory is, there's not one memory. There are many subtypes of memory. And the way they interact is critical in how we follow the course of our lives, how we direct and follow the course of our lives. When I finished my last major book, In an Unspoken Voice, I realized that I would either have to make that book larger or I would have to deal with this topic in a later book, which I did in Trauma and Memory. And I did this really because of the tremendous misunderstanding of traumatic memory and whether memories can be trusted, whether they're true, what can we learn about our memories, when do our memories buoy us up, and our positive forces, when are they maybe even negative forces in our lives? How can we tell the difference, and how can we work effectively with our traumas so that we can put them in the right way in the past, where they belong? So let's just start with, and this is going to be both a neuroscience as well as a clinical talk. So hopefully it'll satisfy your clinical interests as well as your basic scientific and interests as a human being, because we all have memories. I guess that's a truism. Memory systems. Slide three shows the differentiation between the two basic types of memory systems. Let me just see what we have here. Yes, on the left we have what are called explicit memories, and on the right, implicit memories. The explicit memories are conscious. They're mostly deliberative. We can call them up. We use them to go shopping and to kind of our shopping lists or our laundry lists, and we can recall them very consciously. The implicit memory systems, in contrast, are much less conscious. And we have to have special tools to access and work with them because of this. So let's go to slide three. And that's a bit complicated. I'm going to need my glasses, actually, to even read what I have here. Yes. Okay. So, let's go back to three. to slide three. The explicit memory systems are divisible into two distinct ones, or two relatively distinct ones. Those that are called declarative, and those that are called episodic or autobiographical. So the type of memory that I was just talking about, when I'm in Zurich in the summer, working in the summer, I know to which tram to get on. I get on the number 14 tram, then I go to Bahnhof Wiedekern and Wert and Stafakov Plaza. I know all of these things. They're in my declarative memory. And we wouldn't be, that's basically the control system of our GPS. Then there's another type of explicit memory, and that is our episodic memories. And those are vague reminiscences that we have about certain periods of our lives. It's sort of in some way encapsulated. And they're very important in a healthy life. Let me give you an example from my own life. This is taken from Trauma and Memory. I had a horrible experiences in elementary school. I started later in the year. My ears were as big as they are now, but of course my head was smaller, and so I was teased a lot and bullied, and also the teachers were just really horrible, so it was not a very positive experience. Anyhow, in the fifth grade, the first day of fifth grade, some friends of mine and I are walking up Gun Hill Road, and I'm bemoaning how bad this new teacher is. I say, Mrs. Kurtz is the worst teacher I've ever had. She's just so terrible. She's a old, dried up whatever, I don't know. And at that moment, I get a tap on my right shoulder. Can you imagine? I look around, of course, and it's Mrs. Kurtz. And she says, Peter, and she remembered my name. Peter, am I really that terrible, that horrible? And okay, so why was this important? Because Mrs. Kurtz was the first really good teacher that I had. And she really, in many ways, mentored me in a way that when I went to middle school, junior high school, I found a teacher who also served as a mentor, and in high school, and in college, and throughout my whole life. And I really believe that this memory, that learning could be good, and that there would be somebody to actually support me and help me in my learning, really changed the direction I think my life would have gotten had I just had these horrible experiences. Now, as far as my fifth grade year, I really don't remember anything else. I mean, I could maybe get a couple of images here or there, but really, this somehow represents or presents that whole year in my life. And that's what autobiographical memories do. That's the way they serve us. And they're different than declarative memories in that they're soft, they're kind of vague, they're shifting, and you don't really necessarily deliberately get them up, although you can bring them up, but they tend to come at different times. The most famous episodic memory probably is from Marcel Proust's book, Remembrance of Things Past, where he dips a pastry, a madeleine, in his teacup, and then as an adult, and then he's transported to the streets of Dublin where he was as a child. So again, these are something that really encapsulate a period in our lives. Again, they're called episodic or autobiographical memories. Then the implicit memories occur also in two main topics. And those are two main subcategories. Those are emotional and procedural. So emotional memories, well, you know, sometimes you're in a new situation or you're introduced to somebody and all of a sudden you have a strong emotion and you have no idea where that came from. But of course it did come from somewhere. So this is this person that we meet somehow is similar enough to a person that had a strong emotional reaction, very likely a negative reaction. And so that memory is reasserting itself because I'm now taking the present situation and bringing it into the past, or bringing the past into that present situation and coloring it in that way. Then procedural memories, so-called body memories, are things that the body does and it learns. So to learn to dance, that's a procedural memory, a body memory. To learn how to ski, that's a procedural memory, right? To learn how to ride a bike, that's a procedural memory. And we have to learn it really quickly. So with the guidance of a parent or an older sibling who's by our side, we're going together with our bicycle, then they let go. And there you are for the first time piloting your bicycle without falling down. And so procedural learning has to be quick, especially in an instance like this, right? Because if you're not learning quickly, and you can't learn it logically, you can't learn it from declarative memory. You can't say, well, you get on and you shift your weight this way, but if the bicycle turns and shifts, then you shift the other. You have to learn it in your body. It has to be motoric, sensory and motoric. So those are procedural memories. Now there's a type of procedural memories that has not really been understood or even appreciated as a type of procedural memories, and they're so, so important when it comes to trauma. And those are survival-based memories. So the preparation of our body to fight or to flee or to collapse into helplessness, those are also procedural memories. And like all procedural memories, especially these memories, they become very permanent, very fast. They become fixed. So when we've had a traumatic experience and we've tried to defend ourselves, or we've had a threatening experience, we try to defend ourselves, but it's unsuccessful, then that memory becomes locked in, that our body wants to continually actually go to that place, but then to do something different. And that's what we'll be talking about, because the key in resolving trauma is moving through the procedural memories. And again, this is part of the process of bringing the memories to peace, bringing our memories to the past and leaving us in peace. So let's see. Let's go directly to number 6, I think. Okay, I suppose you have that. And this is a map that I made of the different memory systems. So on the top are the more conscious, the explicit memories. And remember, that falls into two categories: declarative, shopping list; episodic, autobiographical, the shifting through one period of time in our lives. Okay, so those are the more conscious. Then below are the implicit memory systems. And you see the emotional, and then below it, the procedural. Now, and this is really critical. The effect of the declarative, of the explicit memory systems upon the implicit systems is very weak. It's almost non-existent. So you see that little teeny little thin arrow going from the pink to the blue. But conversely, however, the effect of the implicit memories are very powerful and affect our autobiographical memories. And I'll give you another example of that. And then the procedural memories have more power, have a lot of power over the emotional, and the emotional has power over the procedural, but not quite as much. But again, you can see by the relative thickness of the different arrows. I'll give you also another example from my grade school. Some 35 years ago, whatever, 40 years ago, I was visiting my parents, and they lived in the Bronx, New York City. And I'd been museum hopping, and I was coming back in the train, the D train, and it was rush hour. And the train was filled with men with gray, mostly gray suits and gray overcoats and newspapers folded under their arms. And I had this strange feeling when I saw this one particular tall man. And I felt it as a kind of an opening in my chest and a warmth in my belly. And so that's curious. So it turned out we both got off on the last stop, 205th Street. And I went up to the man, and I touched his arms, and the words came out of my lips. I did not think of the words. Arnold. And he looks at me, and we look at each other. And I said, Arnold. We were in kindergarten together. And it was Miss Campini. And we looked at each other, just stunned, because somehow I had a procedural memory, an implicit memory of this man's posture, of his face projected over, 35 years. But somehow I recognized him because of the emotional and procedural effect he had on me. So these memories are extremely important. But let's now talk about emotional memory, slide 7, and then to slide 8, with my fractured French, Qu'est-ce qu'une émotion? This was Alfred Binet at the late 1800s, the beginning of the 20th century, and he posed this question, translated, what is an emotion? Well, this is a question that has really perplexed researchers and scientists and clinicians, as we already said. Okay, let's go to the next one. Wow, yikes, hold on. Okay, so the function of an emotional memory is to flag and encode important experiences so that we have them for immediate and potent references. So the example I gave of coming into a party, going to a party, and all of a sudden you're introduced to somebody and this strong emotional reaction. That is telling us they're providing relevant survival and social-based information to inform any appropriate responses in that situation. Of course, when we get stuck in an emotional memory, well, these are rarely appropriate for the present, though they were appropriate for, they may not be appropriate for the present, but they were appropriate for some time in the past. And as such, these memories are vitally important to our individual well-being and that of our survival and the species survival. Okay, so let's go to number 10. Emotional memories, this is repeating, I think, a little bit, but emotional memories generally are triggered by common features in a present situation, as well as similar types and intensities of emotion, along with the needed responses. And those are procedural memories. The responses themselves are procedural memories. And these can be emotions that were successful, or unfortunately also those that were unsuccessful. And the unsuccessful adaptations form the basic terrain of traumatic and so-called neurotic adaptations. Okay, so when we're talking about emotion, of course we have to bring in Charles Darwin, who was made the most important contribution to emotions in his book, his third book, which is at least as valid and important as his other books, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals. So let's go to number 12. According to Darwin, emotions are universal instincts, and he studied those with the same kind of precision that he studied the anatomy and the morphology of animals all over the world. But he noticed that that these are shared by all mammals. Of course, that includes us, though we may not always want to acknowledge that. And these emotions include fear, anger, disgust, sadness, and joy. And I would like to humbly add to this collection curiosity, excitement, and triumph or pride. Okay, so now let's go to 11. Well, those are the emotions again, so-called categorical emotions. So here's the, what do you see here, right? You see something that we would identify as anger. It's a self-protective response. And Paul Ekman elaborated Darwin's categorical emotions and also showed us how these emotions are also experienced as feelings. This is very important, because one of the things that he did, and because there's a lot of confusion between the expression of emotion and the feeling of emotion, the sensorium feeling of emotion. So anyhow, he taught a group of actors to demonstrate different emotions, like anger, by contracting the muscles that would give a similar expression. Fear, well, terror. Oh, I'm sorry. So anger, that would be 17, 18, fear, 19, fear, terror, Edvard Munch's The Scream. And disgust. And here's this guy, that's 21. The person you see in front of your screen is exhibiting a combination of anger and disgust. And it's rather interesting. I've found about 20 pictures of him, and almost all of them have had exactly the same expression. So he is stuck with emotional memories of anger and disgust. You certainly wouldn't want him to be able to make big decisions on going to wars. So, okay, then sadness. Again, we all recognize when we see these, we actually feel them, because that's the other thing about emotions. Are they made to be a vehicle for transmitting to another what we are feeling, and by doing that, transmitting a lot of information. So 22 is sadness, 23 is surprise, and 24 is joy or happiness. Now, early research on emotions has gone in two directions: central brain, peripheral body. And this really represents in many ways the mind-body duality, the mind-body split that we are still suffering from in the wake of Monsieur Descartes. Okay, so 26. Okay, so the central proponents stimulated various parts of the brain to elicit Darwin's categorical emotions. 27. This was Cannon, Bard, Hess, Papez, Ledoux. Hess was the first one to really show that when you stimulated the hypothalamus, you would get rage reactions, very similar to, say, what a cat would exhibit when exposed to a dog. So these are the central theories, that you stimulate the brain somewhere and you see, you observe this emotion, but it doesn't say anything about what we feel in these different emotional states. And indeed, what we feel in much more subtle states, which I call felt sense affects after Eugene Genland's work on focusing. So the peripheral theories are about emotional feelings. Oh, I'm sorry, that would be 28. Then we go to 29. William James, around 1900, actually around the same time as Freud. And he was interested, he knew of Darwin's work, but he was interested in how do these emotions actually feel? And so he would imagine different kinds of situations, such as being chased by a bear, and then notice what kinds of sensations and feelings he experienced in these mental imaginings. Okay, so let's go to page 31. Slide 31. And here's William James. I adore him. And like Darwin, interestingly enough, he had a lot of what in somatic experiencing we call syndrome. He had things like chronic fatigue, irritable bowel, cardiac arrhythmias, both Darwin and James. But in a way, it's kind of what drove these people to this incredible studies. So anyhow, that is my man, William James. Then 32, and this is a quote from James. He says, "Our natural way of thinking about emotions is that the mental perception of some fact excites the mental affection called emotion, and that this later state of mind gives rise to the bodily sensation. My thesis," he says, "on the contrary, is that the bodily changes follow directly the implicit, the unconscious, subconscious, preconscious perception of the exciting fact, and that our feeling of the same change as they occur is the felt emotion." Let's go to 33. So his conclusion on these kind of studies was that we do not run away from the bear because we're afraid of the bear, but rather are afraid because we are running away from the bear. And this was closer, but there's something really, it's not complete. There's something fundamentally missing in this understanding, but we'll get to that in a short period of time. So let's go to 34. Yeah, so again, James' theory was premised on the fact that emotions are often accompanied by autonomic physiological bodily responses, racing heart, tight stomach, sweaty palms, tense muscles, and so on, and that we can sense what is going on inside our body much the same way as we can sense what's going on in the outside of the world. However, this inside world is, in Tantric Buddhism, the universe within. The landscape, the rich, vital landscape of interceptive awareness is really a connection between SE and Tantric Buddhism. In Colorado know of the work of Reggie Ray. He's done really great work on body Tantric Buddhist approaches, and actually, I wrote a little blurb for his last book. So I really encourage you to look at some of his work and about this whole interceptive landscape. Okay, I'm sorry. This is 34. So again, during the act of escape, the body goes through a physiological upheaval. Blood pressure rises, heart rate increases, pupils dilate, palms sweat, muscles contract. And they contract in a way to either fight or to flee, to prepare us to fight or to flee. And also, there's another response we'll speak about a little bit later. There's fight or flight. There's also freezing and collapse, which later gives us the emotional procedural memory of helplessness. In the case of trauma, overwhelming helplessness. Okay, 36. Okay. Okay, one more. We'll just review James's words, that the bodily changes that follow directly from the implicit perception of the exciting fact, and that our feeling of the same changes as they occur, is the emotion. Common sense, we lose our fortune, our sorrow, and sorry, and weep. We meet a bear, are frightened, and run. We are insulted by a rival, are angry, and strike. The hypothesis that he defends here is that this order of sequence is incorrect. It's reversed. That the one mental state is not immediately induced by the other. That the bodily manifestations may first be interposed between the more rational, accurate statement that we feel sorry because we cry, angry because we strike, afraid because we tremble. And again, I say this is only partially correct. So here's somebody running, and according to James, he's frightened because he's running. But I would add that he's frightened because he's running, and he knows that he may not escape, that he may be trapped. He experiences himself as being trapped. And therein lies the fear, emotional memory. And this is a physiological reaction to all the things that go on that affect our different organs and the adrenal sympathetic adrenal system and so forth. And you can see they're all coming from not the frontal parts of the brain, not from the cerebral cortex, but from the most primitive parts of the brain. So whatever it is, the bear, we are genetically programmed when we see a bear or an animal like that coming towards us, we mobilize these extreme amounts of response. And then the experience of those responses is closer to what we can call now the emotion. That's 38. Page 39, I've said that before, the distinction between, the misunderstood distinction between central and peripheral theories is that the first, the central is based entirely on emotional expression, while the peripheral theories are about emotional experience. 39, 40. Now, here is a person who really validated the work that I was beginning to do in Berkeley in the late 60s and early 70s when I was starting to develop the work. And I came across this work by a woman named Nina Bull. And she made the following discovery. Very similar to what I said, fear is not just running. Fear is having the need to run, but feeling that you're unable to run. And she showed that every single emotion, as Darwin's emotions, correspond to a specific posture involving the spine, the body, the whole body in general, and the face. The facial part is Paul Ekman's understanding. So I think I said we're on number 40. And she discovered that if you are in a posture of fear, you cannot experience anything different than fear while you're still in this posture. If you are experiencing the emotion of anger, the wanting to hit but feeling restrained from hitting, That's the posture of anger. And again, he trained people not only to report their sensations, but other people to observe their bodies and report what was going on, which is exactly what I was doing clinically. So this really is kind of the blending together of the emotional and the procedural memories, because these postural fixed are fixed memories. So when people are experiencing habitual emotion like fear or anger or shame, that won't change until the body changes. And that's how we change the procedural memories. This is critical. This is really the basis of everything here. So let's see. Well, we have that. Okay, so let me give you some illustrations here. Around the age of 3 or 4, children begin to learn shame. And here is what I call agitated shame. Just look clearly at the posture. I'm sorry, that's 43. 44 is what I call collapse shame. And this is where the wind is just taken out of you. So when we're in a posture like this, we will continue to have emotional memories about shame. And we'll be only experiencing in the present shame, but we're really experiencing shame from the past projected into the present. Okay, page 45, slide 45, and just an illustration. 46, this is important, because the key in not having a chronic shame, the key is in the parent then says to the child, sweetheart, it's not okay what you did. You can't pull a cat's tail or put your finger in your sister's eyes, but you are still loved. This painting is called 47, called After the Scolding. Again, you see the importance. And when this doesn't happen, we get stuck in this posture of shame. And 49, when repair does not take place in a timely fashion, is what I'm just describing, shame becomes chronic. This leads to the shame-based personality, which again is in a posture. Slide 50. And now the voices of don't do this or you're bad. You see the posture, it's absolutely clear. You see the eyes, the internal introject of the scolding parent is now part of the person's emotional and postural memory system, and it's stuck there. Now, let's see. No, let's go on here. There's a quote from Pema Chodron, a Buddhist teacher, and those of you who are fans of Sounds True, you know she's done things, beautiful things for them. And this is about of how we meet our emotions, but through being able to feel them in ourselves. And she says, if your everyday practice is to open to your emotions, to all the people you meet, to all the situations you encounter without closing down or going back into the past, stuck memories, trusting that you can do that, then that will take you as far as you can go, and you'll understand the teachings of anyone who has ever taught. Wow. Thank you, Prema. Okay. Let's go to 59 here. Slide 59. This is actually something that I did with children way, way, way back in the 70s. And I found this article by a group from Finland. And what they did is they would have the person imagine a different emotion. And then they would have them color in different parts of their body, how much sensation there was in that part of the body. And really, this validates beautifully William James's work. And Nina Bull's work really shows how the felt sensation of the emotion is localized in the body in different places. Many of these illustrations, including this one, is in my book, Trauma and Memory, Brain and Body in the Search for the Living Past. So you can go over these. I know I'm going over them really fast here. Okay, go to 61 now. And, so on the top green, we're walking along, and all of a sudden, there's novelty in our environment. So we stiffen and orient to that, and we assess whether it's dangerous to us or whether it's something that is nourishing for us. We approach or avoid. Then, if it becomes more intense, we fight, flee, or freeze, or fold, collapse. So, with increasing threat, we go from equilibrium to freeze, fold, trauma. But then, when we come out, we move through the procedural memory systems out of collapse into fight or flight energies, and then towards approach of avoidance, towards orientation, and towards equilibrium. So this is a key in how we use the procedural memories to come out of trauma. And we'll show a demonstration here. You know what I'm going to do first? Because I want to make sure we can get this in, and the other one, we'll leave that at the end. Okay. So go to number 64, and this is Ray's story. This is a short documentary, and you can find it on YouTube, of work I did with a Marine who was blown up by two explosive devices in Afghanistan, I think, and then was completely shut down, I mean, profoundly impaired, barely able to function. And you'll see that his body is replaying the procedural memory over and over of the blast in the present. And you'll also see how he's locked down in shame, as you saw in the shame posture. So we'll look at the first few minutes. And again, as I say, you can go to Ray's story, Somatic Experiencing Peter Levine, or something like that. And you can watch the whole thing.
In this video, you will see Ray, a Marine who was blown up by two explosive devices in Iraq. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you will see how he moves from being really severely debilitated by PTSD and other issues.
I don't like it when people take care of me. I can't stand it. Mm. So, I mean,
you want your independence.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted my independence back. And I don't like the idea of being a burden to somebody. In the beginning, I had to kind of teach myself how to walk, talk, and think again. I guess every day it's been getting a little better, kind of.
Now, what kind of medications are you on?
Uh-oh.
You remember?
they got me on like 6 or 7.
Do you know what they're for, supposedly?
Pain.
In fact, Ray had been prescribed a cocktail of powerful medications, not only for pain, but for PTSD, TBI, traumatic brain injury, Tourette's syndrome, and depression.
The involuntary movements that you make with your head and neck like this, when did that begin?
I want to say like a month and a half after the blast.
Okay. Now, I'm going to try to give you an idea.
Okay.
And we'll see where we can go with it, okay?
Okay.
See, the movements that you're making are the kind of movements that your body would have made if there was an explosion. Mm-hmm. You know? And what it's doing is it's kind of repeating those movements over and over again. It's sort of like it got stuck there. And I'd like to see if we can get you some tools so you can stretch this out so that these these reactions are a little bit softer. I want to have you very slowly, very gently, opening and closing your mouth, just the smallest amount, and then come back a little bit, and then just go to where you feel a little resistance. That will trigger those movements probably, but will also give you a chance to feel what's going on before the jerks, okay?
All right.
So just let's just do that together, okay? Mm-hmm. Did you feel what happened that time?
It was just a tingling sensation in my body.
Exactly. What happens when you exposed to something like you've been exposed to, I mean, being in a war zone, and then having an explosion, it's almost like you get jolted right out of your body. And so what we're doing is calling it back into your body.
Making me more, kind of like more entwined with my body. Making me realize what it needs and what it wants.
The shock part has to be worked on first. Otherwise, if you were to work with the emotional part, you would very likely be actually just reactivating even further the shock reaction. And somatic experiencing differentiates between these two.
So what you saw is Ray's body convulsing. And really what it's showing is how his body would have reacted in that moment of the blast. So his eyes and then his head and neck would have been trying to orient towards the source of the explosion to be able to localize it and to know how to respond. But you can't respond to something like that. So even before he could actually move his eyes and head and neck, he was blown into the air. And then his body went into a contraction, like I call it a turtle reflex, where the neck goes into the chest, into the shoulders. It's this kind of response, and the abdominal muscles contracting. So when we were able to begin to break that cycle, to work with the procedural memory, then as soon as he was able to do that, he felt tingling and warmth. And after that first session, he said that the convulsions, which they labeled ridiculously as Tourette syndrome, they were 80% gone. So this really tells you how important the working with procedural memories can be. So let's now, so after we work with this, then we're able to work with his emotional memories. Because you have to, in that, remember that first, that earlier slide where you have the implicit memories below and then the implicit memories above. So you have to be able to work from the bottom upwards in healing these kind of trauma. And so by working through the procedural memories, then the emotional memories were accessible. We couldn't have worked with them until the procedural memories had been worked with first. So let's take this is the fourth or fifth session, I guess, in that we were actually doing at Esalen Institute. So you'll see Ray beginning to deal with the guilt, the survivor's guilt, the rage. What's underneath the rage is his strength and his sorrow, his sadness. So he's able to process these emotional memories. So then show the second part of Ray.
Here's the idea, to direct the rage into this pillow, okay? And they're gonna keep you safe so that your rage is contained.
I'm having them, in a way, take over the holding back function so that Ray can just feel, in a safe way, the impulse to strike out.
Really get let your rage come right into here. And to know together we can all handle it.
And again, in a way that it's contained, that it's not going into a rage reaction, but towards what I call healthy aggression. And this is important because this is important in carrying out our lives in a successful way. We have to have healthy aggression.
Oh. There you go. There you go. And resting. Just rest. What are you noticing? What are you feeling in your fingers, your hands?
Strength.
Strength.
My ridge doesn't really feel as strong.
Uh-huh.
As it was.
Good.
I know what it's like to feel helpless. Knowing that you can't save anybody.
Yeah.
I know what it's like to watch somebody die right in front of your eyes. Knowing that there's nothing that you can do.
So you saw with the group support how he was able to channel and direct, contain and direct his rage, not expressing it mindlessly, because that can just reinforce the traumatic memory. With the support and with the containment, you could see him being able to move out of the rage, and to experience the softer feelings, the loss, and the grief, and to experience that by not having one of his buddies by his side, but by having me with him at his side in doing that. His courage to do that, to have fought first in the battle and then in the inner battlefield of his trauma and his emotions. So what I'm going to do now here is I'm going to very quickly give you another example of how these memories occur in animals. And let's do the impala. So that should pretty well take us to 5 o'clock. So go ahead. And again, just watch and listen and be amazed.
She dashes forward. This time, Duma has killed a good-sized female impala. Unfortunately, in the plane, one's own gratification often stimulates another's envy. Duma's catch has been witnessed from start to finish. The spy is Mama Kingua, a spotted hyena. She knows that Duma is completely exhausted by her final sprint. And yet, things may not finish as we thought they would. For sometimes the weak are capable of cunning trickery.
Okay, so that was fun. This is the same responses that we have when experiencing overwhelming life threat. And in nature's benevolence, the gazelle or the person doesn't feel the pain or even the terror of being ripped apart. And it's a defense strategy that is sometimes more effective than the more active fight or flight. Well, as we saw with the animal. Now, the animal, when it came out of what I call the immobility response, or the fear potentiate, or the immobility response, that is a procedural memory. It just flips over, and then off it goes, as though nothing had happened, not traumatized. But we become highly traumatized when we're in that death's grips, or perceive that we're in death's grips. And so what happens is when people begin to come out of the shutdown state or the the freeze collapse state, there's a tremendous release of energy, as you saw with the Impala, because it now goes into the fight or flight, into the flight in this case, full steam ahead. And there's no way that the cheetah is there's no way that the cheetah is going to be able to catch it this time because she's spent from the chase. So it's tremendously successful. But the problem is, when people come out of the immobility state, the very sensations that will take them out and back into equilibrium and to balance, homeostasis, we become frightened of those. And we block them. So go to slide number 65. And there you see the person come out of shutdown into hyperarousal, back into shutdown, hyperarousal. It's kind of the bipolarity of trauma. Whoop. Okay, let's go to slide 67. And we work therapeutically with those autonomic memories, as it were, procedural autonomic memories, and then we get closer to a equilibrium range, and then in slide 67, we restore homeostasis. Now, one more photograph here. Ah, yes. Okay. This is number. Well, I have two more. 70, slide 70. And this is the problem when we're working, when the person, say a client, is in a fearful state and they try to recall memories or to recover memories. What happens, and this isn't exactly right, and I explained it in Trauma and Memory, that we go, when we're in the activated state, we will connect with memory engrams with similar somatic markers. That's what, in other words, with a similar felt sense affects. And these can include muscle tension, constriction, vibration, shaking, weakness, increase, decrease, heart rate, et cetera, et cetera. So, but then, because we've gone into the memory in a distressed state, then that actually reinforces our present state, and we are more fearful, more agitated, which then drives it down into that memory engram, that emotional procedural memory engram, and it just goes around in what I call a positive feedback loop with negative consequences leading to terror, panic, or rage. So a key in trauma is help people to come very slowly in a titrated way to these emotional and procedural memories so that they, instead of being overwhelmed by them, they can process them and put them behind. They can touch them instead of being swallowed up by them. And when this happens, and there's this beautiful example from a Japanese tradition called wabi-sabi, not sure I'm pronouncing it anywhere near correctly. And the idea is when a bowl breaks, a ceramic bowl breaks, what they do is they fill the break with gold, which shows that it creates great art out of broken things. And Hemingway said this way, I think it was Hemingway, said, all of us are broken throughout our lives, but some of us come out stronger. And I believe when we work with traumatic memories in this gradual, titrated way, we greatly increase the likelihood that we will be stronger. We will be made stronger from healing our traumas. So, I guess that's almost it here. It's just 65 minutes, all right. So, do we take questions now? What happens?
Yes, we've certainly got some questions for you. And I'd like to take this moment to invite our participants to submit any questions that you might have for Peter. And you can do so by entering them into the field just below this video. Peter, I'd like to pick up toward the end of that presentation and ask you a little bit about that work of the patient or client going into hyperarousal and then dropping back down. You mentioned in your book, Healing Trauma, the story of Nancy and how you got her to loosen her neck and then her pulse went down and then it shot back up. Can you say a little bit more about that experience? Because that seemed to set you on this path that we're talking about today.
Indeed. I think you're talking about the Sounds True Healing Trauma book CD.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Okay. I was asked to see this woman by a psychiatrist friend of mine. And she had been referred to him because she went from doctor to doctor and they were unable to diagnose all of these diverse and changing physical symptoms that she was having. Probably now she would be diagnosed with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, or irritable bowel, and migraines and so on. But also she suffered severe panic attacks and could not even leave the house alone, agoraphobia. And so I was starting to develop some relaxation exercises in the 60s. And my psychiatrist friend thought that that might be helpful, at least for her anxiety, that if we could help her anxiety, at least she'd be able to get out of the house and do some things. So she came in with her husband. And her, I could tell her pulse was going at about 120 beats a minute from her carotid pulse. I could see that in her neck. And so I started to teach her some of these neck relaxation exercises that I had already found out that when I worked with a number of people with high blood pressure, that often it would reduce the blood pressure by as much as 20 points. So sometimes people go from 40 down to 120. And so we wanted to see if this would help with her anxiety. And as I got her to begin to release those neck muscles, her heart rate started going down and down. But then, boom, they shot up to about 140, 150 beats a minute. And this is what we were talking about, right? When you start going down in the arousal state, then it may shoot up unexpectedly. And so what did I do when that happened? Well, I did probably the stupidest thing that I could do. Your audience can maybe imagine what that would be. I said, Nancy, you must relax. You need to relax. Relax, something like that. But much to my astonishment, her heart rate started going down, and I was quite relieved. But it continued to go down, down, and down to 60 beats, 50 beats, and she turned white. And she looked at me, her eyes were just open in terror. And she just locked onto my eyes and said, Doctor, I'm dying. Don't let me die. Help me. And I that moment in my fear, even if I tell you this right now, my chest gets a little bit tight. It doesn't stay that way, fortunately. And it's like an episodic memory. Anyhow, at that moment, I had an image that occurred in my mind of a tiger getting ready to pounce, to prepare to pounce. And I said, Nancy, there's a tiger. The tiger's chasing you. Run, climb those rocks, and escape. And that's exactly what she did in her image. And for a period of 40 minutes, her body would turn, her hands would be freezing cold and then warm. She would shake and tremble. There'd be perspiration, then a deep spontaneous breath. And this would go on for several, for the better part of an hour, for about 40 minutes. And you could see finally she was in a very restful state. She opened her eyes, this time without any fear. And she said, "Doctor, do you want to know what happened?" And I said, "Yeah, I would like to know." She said, "Well, I was feeling terrified, like I couldn't breathe, like I was going to die. And when you told me to run and climb the rocks, at first I could barely move, but then I felt myself moving, climbing the rocks. And when I got to the top, I looked down, and instead of seeing the tiger, I saw myself as a four-year-old child being held down by doctors and nurses and being administered ether in a tonsillectomy." And that's in the 40s and 50s. That's the way, even into the early 60s, that's the way these surgeries were done for children. And being held down and terrified of suffocating, it was going into this death terror state. So as we were able to work that procedural memory from frozenness to running and to escape, and then instead of her heart rate just shooting way, way up and then way, way down, she started to regulate. And then at the end of the session, she had a nice, even heart rate of about a 75, 74 beats a minute, I think. And so that was, again, the first idea that I didn't realize that this was a procedural memory. But this let me know, as I would later understand, that the reworking of the procedural memories is what's the key in putting to rest both the emotional memories and the entire traumatic memory to rest.
Now, I have a question from Athena, who asks, how can we best bring implicit memory to consciousness in order to heal trauma?
That is a very good question. And you can't do it by thoughts. You can only do it by emotional feelings, and sensations. Thank you for bringing this up, and I apologize for not mentioning it, because the language in most talk therapies, we're talking, you know, from our frontal brain, we're talking thoughts, cognitions, and so forth. The language of our emotional brains are the emotions, but the language of our procedural memories are those of sensations, and that's why somatic experiencing, that's the term I gave to it, is about accessing these bodily sensations and letting them take the person to where their trauma has been stuck, and then to be able to complete those responses and then heal the trauma.
This one comes from Lee. Are you familiar with trauma release exercises that encourage shaking and vibrating to free the nervous system from trauma? And if so, would you suggest these practices?
Well, yes. I think that basically there are a series of bioenergetic exercises, which are good. They're good exercises. And they can be helpful, I think, when you have somebody who's had a relatively recent single trauma event. I think they're way too activating for people who have had a lot of trauma in their history. So I definitely wouldn't recommend it for that. But for like single events with a relatively healthy person, I think that can be a good way to release it, so it doesn't become encoded as a trauma.
Amal writes, let's say a child developed a chronic sense of shame. What is the best way to help the child heal?
That's a very good question, you know, because we're mostly talking about adults and how you would work with shame in adults. But sometimes what I'll work with children actually directly, I have them, we imitate each other's, we make different postures. And then they make the posture and I imitate it, and or then I make a posture and they imitate it. So they get a sense of how actually they can change their emotions by having their posture change. Because I do have them do it very slowly. That's the key. It's not just sitting up straight or something like that. You have to actually feel it from the inside. So we play games around that. And then when we get to the posture of shame, I kind of a little bit like reflect that and lead them a little bit into it, but then we start to come out of it. So touching into that posture of shame and then slowly coming out of it. And we make that as a game. And then often they'll talk about what they were shamed about, but not always, and it's certainly not necessary. And really the same approach I use for adults, I've used for adults for 40 years. And many therapists, you know, realize it's very, to know that it's not easy to work with shame. It can be very, becomes very entrenched and very tricky. And working to change the posture of shame, as Nina Bull discovered in her research, is, I believe, the most effective. And it's not the only thing. You work with other things as well, because shame usually happens in a relationship where there's been a fracturing or a betrayal in the relationship. So we have to kind of help to heal that as well, to renegotiate that as well. But basically, the principle is the same.
I'd like to ask a little bit about that, about eliciting support from not just our family, but also partners, colleagues, close friends. How can we create a network of support while we are working toward healing trauma?
Thank you. Thank you. You know, there's a Motown song. It goes like this. Takes one to stand in the dark alone. Takes two to let the light shine through. And as much as I know how to guide people, and to some degree to guide myself with this, when I was hit by a car, I needed somebody, this is in my book, In an Unspoken Voice, at the first chapter, I needed somebody to be there with me. It turned out to be a pediatrician. And she sat down and she stayed with me. It really makes a big difference when we're with somebody else. And the exercises that I did in the Healing Trauma book CD, those are exercises that, of course, can be practiced alone, but are best practice together with another person. It really makes a difference to have somebody there at your side so that you're not alone with this, because a lot of trauma happens when we're left alone.
Question comes from Steve. When I'm remembering someone fondly, is that an example of my selective impressions of the past reshaping or reframing my implicit memory?
Yes, and well, this is more probably about you know, what we talked about, episodic or autobiographical memories. So you reflect on a friend and so forth, and that's a good feeling. But maybe something really bad happened with that friend, and so then you are very likely to actually use that episodic memory to access an emotional memory, and then in turn to access a procedural memory. So again, it's a really, really good question. And we can use episodic memories to connect us to the emotional and procedural memories. Yes, absolutely. Although generally they come out of sensation and emotion, but they can come somewhat from autobiographical memories.
Now, Peter, you were saying that the process of healing trauma is a gradual one, that you take the client through very slowly or in stages. I wonder, what is the role of forgiveness and compassion, especially toward the self, in this process?
Yeah. Well, you know, when we've been traumatized and shamed, you know, it really constricts our whole life. And when people start to free themselves from this by gradually touching into these emotions and these sensations, you know, there's a part that people sometimes feel, it's a particular kind of grief. It's like, wow, I had to suffer all this time. And where I believe self-compassion comes in is, yes, I have suffered, and now I can live more fully. And that's done in a compassionate way. And I really think that working with trauma in general connects people, connects them to themselves in a more compassionate way and to all others. You know, when people have heal their own traumas, they're less likely to want to inflict traumas on other people.
Mm-hmm. Kara has a question that kind of rides on this one. And if you have anything more to say about the response, maybe we can go from there. She writes, I find myself wanting to hold my past caretakers accountable for actions that they don't want to admit. Every time I see them, I freeze and later fill with rage. How can I move past this self-imposed suffering?
Oh, Tara, this is such a beautiful question, such an important question. And it happens so frequently, you know, when we recover some of our different experiences, our memories and so forth, you know, we want, it's a natural drive to get justice. And we want to hold people accountable. And unfortunately, they're not often willing, probably because of their own traumas. But the key here is that we don't have to freeze and go into rage, because when we've worked on that enough, we can be present with ourselves, we can compassionate of ourselves, and we can protect ourselves from this kind of continued really abuse in many cases. So I think the key is whether they're going to make themselves accountable or not. We're in much better shape if we don't go into the freeze and rage when we're with them or when we're even thinking about them. So I think that's the key there. And you know, Tara, I just wish that people who are abusive take responsibility and do that. And right now, of course, we have the model of exactly the opposite, right, in our highest office. And it's horrible. And many people who have been traumatized, you know, this is reactivated some of their traumas, because you have somebody who is clearly an abuser who just makes light of it. So the main thing is that we don't freeze, that we don't get stuck in our rage. Like, remember with Ray, the Marine, when he's able to actually direct his rage into strength, then you can more protect yourself and protect that inner child against what is very likely to be a refusal of accountability by the abusers, the perpetrators. So I wish you luck, and I wish things were the way they should be, but they are often not.
We have time for quite possibly two more questions. We'll see how this one goes. In your work, you say that, according to your teaching, opening to the authentic or the enduring self, the self that lives beyond trauma, that feels like it's a journey of a lifetime, simply because we're always evolving. Can you say a little bit more about what authenticity means in your work?
Well, you just did. You did a great job. Authenticity to me is to experience the self as it is, unencumbered by all of the socialization and the trauma. The part that is like the flickering light of the candle that never goes out. It may dim, but it never goes out. And when we can gently direct our attention in its direction, it will grow in warmth and strength. And it's the part, you know, it's difficult to define, but it's also, it shouldn't be completely difficult, but it's hard to get the right words. But it is this part where you know that no matter what has happened to you, that you are okay, and that you are more okay, and that you are able to thrive, that you are able to feel yourselves as being alive, alive and real. Mm-hmm. And really, that's where it's at. So to feel our own vitality, our own aliveness, to me, that's as close as you can get to understanding the authentic self. I mean, there are other elements of that, but it's to feel alive, to be alive in a living, sensing, feeling, knowing body. To me, that's what the authentic self is about.
Peter, before we go, can you give us a tiny practice or a point of guidance to help us tap into that authentic and most alive self, particularly when we feel ourselves going down that well of being triggered?
Yes, yes. One of the exercises that I'm pretty sure it's in Healing Trauma, and the idea here is to just take an easy, deep, full breath, and then on the exhalation, make the sound voo, as though it's coming from the belly. And just allow the breath and the sound to go all the way out, and then allow the breath to come in on its own to fill the belly and then into the chest, and then again to make the voo. And I'll do it, and then I'll invite anybody who wants to do it with us. I mean, there are important neurophysiological reasons for this, and there are also it's an important theoretical framework called the polyvagal theory of Stephen Porges. But for now, what we're wanting to do is connect with that part that is our aliveness. And if you're doing it and you feel sensations that feel too intense, then just rest. You can also do another little exercise. Okay, let's see if this works here. Yes, if you're feeling like the sensations are intense or feeling like you might be overwhelmed, this is also in the book CD. Just take your right hand, put it underneath your arm by your heart, and take your other hand like this. And just so you know that you are holding, that you are helping contain the different sensations and feelings that might be difficult at first. So let's start with the voom, okay? So again, let's see. Well, okay, here's my hand on my belly, even though my belly is a little higher here in the picture. So, easy, full breath. And I let the breath come in. So just doing it once or twice. And I'm inviting anybody and everyone to partake in the exercise, if you like, or to imagine doing it. Sometimes that's almost as good. Sometimes it's better. So, full, easy breath. Vibrating it down in the belly. Letting the breath fill your belly and chest. Wonderful. feel your sensations and feelings, whatever you're noticing.
I feel a little bit of effervescence.
Mm-hmm.
That's very nice.
Yeah. Vibration, warmth, connectedness, settledness. I mean, many, many things. It can also be an agitation. And if it is, again, just using that containing exercises. Okay. So I'm going to have to end it on that. Okay.
Peter, thank you so very much for this presentation tonight.
All right. Okay. Thank you all.
This concludes the sixth live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. We'd like to thank Dr. Peter Levine again for this outstanding presentation. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. We'd also like to thank everyone who joined us tonight. We really appreciated your participations and the questions that you sent in as well. Please join us for our next live session with Dan Siegel, and that's going to take place tomorrow on March 23rd, 2017 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.